But let's welcome Gareth and Liam. Kia ora, welcome.
Kia ora, morena.
Great to have you with us, and we'll just run through your introductions. And Gareth, of course, a former Green MP, now works for the Wellbeing Economy Alliance Aotearoa, no longer a member of the party. Liam here is a Palmerston North lawyer, political commentator, and a member of the National Party. Let's begin, though, with the old saying attributed to James Carville in the Clinton era: it's the economy, stupid. Now, the OCR rise of 75 basis points last week was, as many had predicted, some questioning whether it was too much. But the Reserve Bank's very strong words, amounting to engineering a recession if we all don't stop spending so much, really made for quite bleak listening and reading for any incumbent governments. Liam, do you want to kick off on the implications of that?
Well, I mean, this is the dominant, is going to be the dominant sort of thing and issue for the coming year and for the next election. Look, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's really interesting, that's really great for politics nerds to debate, things like the entrenchment of, you know, legislation. But where politics really intersects with people's daily lives is exactly this: the price that they pay at the petrol, their mortgage interest rates, how much food costs, and all of it's coming together in quite a horrible, messy way. Look, the government will bear the brunt of blame for the economic misery to come, or the economic hard times at the very least. You know, and in some regards, that's not fair on the government. You know, the government is doesn't control the economy, but they also take the credit when things are going well. Voters reward them when the economic times are good, and they will do the same when the economic times are bad. And this is really going to be what the election is going to be about next year.
Gareth, your take on the impact on Labor's chances?
Yeah, well, I mean, the recession is going to have a huge human cost from unemployment, reduced life expectancy, poor educational outcomes. But from Labor's political perspective, you know, it's a perfect storm of negative news. You've got the next year, the economy in recession, inflation's probably still going to be high. We could be looking at 5% unemployment, 7% interest rates when houses are coming off those fixed rates. House prices continue to fall. You know, the mood could be really quite sour. And we know internationally that that does hurt incumbents. Add into that, Labor's probably going to be wearing a fiscal straitjacket. So while they'll be wanting to help people, particularly low and middle-income voters that will be most severely affected by the recession and by interest rates, they'll be pretty reluctant to really dish the cash and splash that around in election year. We'll see their fiscal window when the budget policy statement and the half-year economic update come out pretty soon. We'll see how much money they've got to play, but it really is a perfect storm, and it's going to be a very difficult place. It's probably an understatement to say this is not where you'd want to campaign from, but the election's still a year away. A lot can happen before then, and when you look across the ditch in Victoria, a third-term Labor government was just re-elected there despite the difficult economic conditions there as well.
Liam, what also became clear, and it's been hard to get either the finance minister or the Reserve Bank governor really to fully acknowledge this, but there was an acknowledgement of the element of domestic inflation that is part of this. You always take an inflation number and you pare away what is imported, and that includes things like the supply chain cost rises, energy price rises, but then there is the domestic, the so-called non-tradable sector. It's going to interfere with Labor's line that a lot of these stresses, most of these stresses, all of these stresses, are as a result of international conditions.
Yeah, I mean, it was never a really a completely credible throwaway line. Look, you know, ultimately there are things that government can control and there are things that the government can't control. The government can't control supply chains, but they can control poor quality spending. They can control injecting money into the system that doesn't make a material difference to anyone's lives but adds to the inflationary pressures. And a really good example of that would be the choice to make the cost of living payment something that was warned by Treasury to have inflationary effects. And the government did it anyway for political reasons. But really, has it really helped anyone in the long term? It was a small cash injection that was like pouring water on sand in the inflationary environment. So look, the government can deflect, it can point to overseas trends, but ultimately voters don't buy it because we elect the government to be responsible. And in fact, there are things that they can control. And if the government can put its hand on its heart and say, look, we've done everything we can to keep the cost of living down and therefore to keep inflation, so interest rates in check, well, the voters might then give them a pass or they might credit them for it. But can the government honestly say that with its hand on heart? Probably not.
Gareth, this is one of the challenges for what Labor might have wanted to do and governments have previously done in the run-up to an election. Most memorably, Grant Robertson in the role as a staffer to Helen Clark's governments, pulling out the student loans interest-free policy. And this is to Liam's point. The Reserve Bank is now pointing not only at domestic inflation and inflation, but at government spending itself as part of this. So to what extent is it going to curb its instincts to do things that might be short-term popular, but just feed into the inflation argument?
Yeah, well, Robertson in his interview over the weekend, I think, went back to some of those conservative instincts, which he has demonstrated throughout his term. He was pointing out how government expenditure, you know, had jumped up to 35%, similar in line with the GFC response under National, and then has dropped down and continues to drop. We'll see what his economic room to play with the budget next year is pretty soon. But what their strategy, it seems to be at the moment, is very much contrasting with overseas. Constantly over the weekend, Grant Robertson was saying we're in a better position to weather the storm. And you've got to remember, a lot of the tools and policies that were rolled out at haste over COVID were actually supported by National and the opposition. They've got a different perspective now with the benefit of hindsight and different conditions. But they're going to keep playing that line that we're in a better position than other countries. They're going to keep questioning the reliability and the untrusted opposition. And I think we saw that with Luxon. He's unable to answer some basic questions around where their policy process is going. So they're going to, I think, quite frankly, have a campaign based around fear of the opposition and constantly trying to strengthen that. And I guess they're ultimately hoping for two things. By September, November, things are improving. You know, spring's around the corner. The All Blacks are World Cup champions. and it's in the rearview mirror. Or, ironically, things are even worse. And given we know how strong the Prime Minister in particular and Robertson have been in a crisis, ironically, they could be hoping that things are even worse, which would play to their strengths.
All right. Well, what National did use very quickly, I think within minutes, slightly exaggerating, on the day of this very sobering report by the Reserve Bank was use it to ditch some of its tax cuts, and particularly some of the more controversial tax cuts, making itself a smaller target on that front, Liam, or at least giving itself loads of wriggle room.
Yeah, it did seem like a real reaction. What I can tell you is that this is actually something that Nationals probably wanted to do for a little bit. It's been percolating away. It's been talked about by MPs. It's been talked about by MPs with party members. So look, it's very National is fortunate in that they can tie dropping an unpopular policy to the needs of the time, right? So you know, we are in a very inflationary environment. National can say and it can front it to its supporters and say, look, you know, we can't go out there and hammer the government on inflation while having a policy that will have the result of injecting more money into the economy, which is has an inflationary effect. So, you know, it's one of those things where I think, you know, the cutting top tax rates is never going to be popular with the public. Maybe it's the right thing to do sometimes. I certainly am a low tax guy, but it's not a popular move. But it's been sort of fortunate for National that they've been able to distance themselves from this policy while reserving the right to bring it in later and to be able to tie it to inflation. So, you know, I think it's actually been, you know, in fairness to them, it's been fairly well played by them.
Gareth, do you have any comment, or is it just...
I just think it's you know, good politics, convenient timing to use this as the excuse that everything's changed, according to Luxon, to swallow this dead rat. Look, it's been a pretty untenable policy for a while. Even, you know, Don Brash, you know, quite on the right of politics, thinks tax cuts are the wrong prescription right now. I did see that ACT put out a press release mocking National for its lack of spine. But the fact is, if you take away all the equity and fairness issues of our unfair tax system, just on the inflationary perspective, perspective, the fact is a large tax cut like that would be inflationary unless it's accompanied by large spending cuts. And the Axe Party might want to go into election arguing for where they're going to slash and burn, but I don't think National really wanted to do that. So, look, good tactics.
Okay, now to the Three Waters and some legislation beginning to enter Parliament. A late SOP or addition to legislation under debate came through last week, seeking to effectively entrench a clause that would prevent privatisation of these entities that are to be set up. I think National itself definitely not wanting to support the concept of privatisation, but what has happened, of course, is a great concern about the use of an entrenchment clause in anything other than to do with electoral law. Liam, just explain, please, what the debate is that has unfolded.
Oh, well, I mean, we have a sovereign parliament, so by default, the parliament can make any law that it wants by passing a bill with a majority of members, which then receives the royal assent. And so, the parliament really has very, very few scope limits on its lawmaking abilities. Now, in theory, some law is retrenched, and that means that entrenched, and that means that parliament has set a higher threshold for itself in terms of amending certain laws. So on its face, certain elements of the Electoral Act, including the voting age, interestingly, can only be amended if 75% of the House of Representatives vote in favour. That's a very, very high threshold, really represents a consensus. Now, what the government has done, or what the government and the Greens have done in a late move, have tacked on to the Three Waters Bill an entrenchment clause to protect certain parts of the new regime or the new reform from amendment by an ordinary majority. And so the issue around that is that, it's one thing to protect the sort of constitutional issues. You know, everyone agrees with that. And in fact, nobody would think it would be a good idea to try and change the electoral system in any sort of fundamental way without a consensus. But what we're talking about is economic policy. So I don't want to see water privatised. I think that's sort of a pretty core government function. But the idea that we start down the route of trying to bind and tie future parliaments on economic matters is worrying because it's sort of got an anti-democratic feel to it. You know, it's like trying to make a temporary majority permanent or closer to being permanent. And so you had a whole lot of constitutional lawyers and academics and people who follow these sorts of things, you know, express their concern pretty carefully, pretty loudly. And in addition to that, it's sort of been snuck through. This hasn't gone through the normal parliamentary process. It's been passed under urgency. So you've got a couple of factors there that are looking a bit dodgy from the government. And I think that I don't think it's going to withstand. I think that the I don't think this is going to go ahead in its current form. I'll eat my hat if the Three Waters gets entrenched.
Okay, we heard this morning from the Prime Minister under questioning three times, I think, from Corinne Dan about whether this would go, this addition. And I think the most he got out of her was that there would be a chat about it at Cabinet on Monday, which is a very inauspicious way of perhaps signalling, yes, it might go. What is your take on the fundamental argument, first of all, Gareth, and then on what might happen?
Well, it's possibly a good idea to discuss the idea that long-term strategic infrastructure, you would want a higher parliamentary threshold to protect it. However, this was absolutely the wrong way to go about it. You know, when you look at some of the Scandinavian countries, they do have provisions like this for policies where both parties or the parliament agrees to entrench it in the long term. But again, this isn't what happened in this case. And it's another example how we see bad lawmaking under urgency. And quite frankly, the Three Waters Bill was only going through under urgency because of the political expediency trying to clear it off the desks before Christmas. So look, for the Greens, I mean, they've only got a few areas where they're working with the government on policy wins. So, you know, fair credit for them to be opportunistic and to get a policy win. But the fact is, this was the wrong way to go about it. Entrenchment provisions always should have bipartisan, at least, or ideally a consensus in Parliament. Otherwise, we get the bad precedent, which is what the constitutional law experts are warning about, that we could see this become a normal practice in the future, that regular policies, which people hold a variety of opinions on, could become subject to these entrenchment provisions in the future. And ultimately, we could see a less effective parliament and government system in New Zealand. And we want to avoid sort of that deadlock and breakdowns we see in the US. So full credit to Dean Knight and the other constitutional law experts who picked up on this. It's a bit of an indictment of the opposition, I think, that during the debate, they didn't actually notice this. They didn't raise it in the debate. It was only afterwards when it was brought to their attention on Twitter. But I think, you know, on the issue, it's something we should consider. Should we have, alongside electoral provisions, other areas where we can have a national conversation, national agreement that these areas do need a higher threshold? But I think, you know, given the poor process, the bad precedent, we probably will highly likely see this legislation recommitted to the committee stage. Just as a former MP's perspective here, the committee of the stage house, where the parliament, the whole collection of MPs can amend legislation, can be really fast moving. Anyone can put an amendment on the table. You don't have the time to take it back to your full caucus for a vote. It looks like that has probably happened in this situation, where a small group of Labour MPs agreed with the Honourable Eugenie Sage's amendment, and now they'll take it back to the cabinet and reconsider it.
Committee of the whole house, just to sort of help people out, you go through your first reading, it goes off to select committee, and is considered by that smaller grouping of MPs, and you've probably heard all of us railing about what has happened to that process in recent times and coverage of that process. Then it comes back to the House and the Committee of the Whole House. Everyone can have another go at that legislation, but as you say, there's a lot to consider, and it's often quite a short time frame for that debate before heading off to its final vote. So it sounds like both of you, that chat on Monday at Cabinet might yield significant change, one thinks. Let's just touch on some others. We've got so much we could touch on. Obviously, law and order is a growing issue, and the awful killing of a shop worker, a dairy worker in Auckland in the PM's own electorate is very much in the spotlight at the moment. That has been fairly well traversed, and I'm sure we'll be back to it. Just a couple that are sneaking by. Lowering the voting age, you mentioned there that would be one area, Liam, that would require that higher majority in order to succeed. What do you think will happen? Do you think there's a chance of it coming in at least at local government level?
I think that we will see it come at the local level, and the reason is that it just represents a half measure, and so this government is very, very fond of half measures. There is, in fact, a good argument that you could make that the government can actually override the entrenched provisions of the Electoral Act and just lower the voting age to 16 across the board anyway. But no, I don't think that they would want to sort of touch that electorate fence, and I think what we'll see is, yeah, it will be reduced to 16. That won't be popular, but it also won't cost the government a lot of votes. So it seems like a real classic half measure from this government.
Gareth?
And this is the norm overseas. I mean, you look at Scotland, 16-year-olds can vote for the Scottish Parliament, but it's a higher age for the UK Parliament. Look, I'm a big supporter of it because, apart from the fact that, you know, a lot of 16-year-olds are a lot more engaged in the issues of the day and the future than a lot of, frankly, older voters. But what I like about it is it actually sees them vote with their peers at a time where they're learning about civics and how Parliament society works at school. And what we know from the academic evidence is if you vote the first time, you're much more likely to vote in subsequent elections. So I see this as a great way that we could be boosting turnout in the medium to long term. I think the government's going to look for a mechanism to make sure it applies to that local level. It's highly unlikely we're going to pass that 75% threshold. Thomas Coughlin was doing the numbers of MPs, and I think there was only about 54 votes in favour as of last week. They need 90. That's why it was quite surprising the PM pinned her mask to the colours to the mask quite strongly last week, given it's unpopular, you know, doomed to fail, and takes away from that core economic message. But look, I think it would be a positive step forward if they put the provision for local government, which on Labour's votes alone would be able to pass and would be a positive development.
I think we'll touch on it very quickly just to mark it. We won't be able to give it sufficient time this morning, but no one seems very happy really with what the changes that have been made and the compromises, to use that word again, to the so-called hate speech laws. Could each of you just quickly comment? I'm sure it's a matter we'll return to, but what did we learn in the last week? Liam?
Well, I think, you know, it's one of those classic areas where the government has a very good concept in mind, or they're very clear on the concept. But, you know, hate speech laws are really, really hard to get right. I mean, if we look to the United States, where they have very, very strong freedom of expression jurisprudence, You know, there are very, very, very few hate speech codes or laws that ever end up being enforceable because they are just so hard to, they're so subjective, they're so hard to get right. I mean, our current hate speech law on the books is basically unenforced because it's just too difficult to enforce. So it's one of those things where I think the government said, right, we've got to do something. They had a very clear concept in mind. But when it, when the rubber hit the road, when it came to legally define the types of things that they wanted to censor, they just continued to come unstuck. And we had a series of, frankly, you know, sort of cringy sort of interviews where the government couldn't define what it wanted to ban. But again, it's got to show progress, and so it's going to do basically the minimum that it could do. It's kind of baffling that it hasn't included sexual orientation and gender identity as part of the expanded hate speech law. But it's basically, I think, it's almost like a white flag in that they're not going to make anyone happy.
Okay, Liam, final word.
Yeah, just that Liam's correct. I mean, there's only been one successful prosecution in 29 years under the existing regime. This reform was meant to strengthen that regime and add those other areas such as LGBTQI. Look, I think no one's happy with this decision. I think the current minister got a bit of a hospital pass from Chris Farfoy, the previous minister who couldn't say, you know, previously if a boomer or a Karen would be considered under the legislation. They're kicking for touch by sending it back to the Law Commission for advice. No one. Everyone's happy, everyone's disappointed, but I guess they'll be hoping to take the heat out of this issue through this hospital pass and kicking it to touch.
Thank you very much, both of you, Gareth Hughes and Liam Hare.